Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Tonight on The Readout.
All I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have.
Trump's crooked plan to steal Georgia takes center stage before the January 6th committee, as we're learning more about the equally crooked effort to submit fake electors, which everyone in Trump's inner circle seemed to understand was completely illegal. Also tonight, it's right out in the open now. New evidence of the violence and menace at the heart of today's MAGA-driven Republican Party. But first, I want to show you a bizarro moment from the 2020 news wormhole that you probably don't remember.
The electors are already here. They've been checked in.
They're also electors.
All 16 electors that we've been advised by the governor's staff that we're going to be here to vote in the Electoral College have been checked in. They're already here.
But these are the rest of the electors.
It's the official sealed document. Okay. The certificate of ascertainment has also the GOP electors. They are here. They're trying to do their constitutional duty.
I understand.
Their constitutional duty requires them to be at the Senate chamber today at 2 p.m.
Now, what you just watched was a group of people claiming to be official electors from the swing state of Michigan on December 14, 2020, demanding to be allowed in to participate in the Electoral College process, despite the fact that Joe Biden won Michigan by more than 150,000 votes. And his electors, the official ones, were already in the room. Michigan was one of seven states that Biden won where Trump electors showed up anyway that day, insisting that Trump had actually won and that their electoral votes should be counted too, just in case. They even signed legal-looking documents, falsely claiming to be the real electors. As the Washington Post points out, at the time, the gathering seemed like a slapdash, desperate attempt to mimic then-President Donald Trump's refusal to concede. But they report that internal campaign emails and memos reveal that the convening of the fake electors appeared to be a much more concerted strategy. In fact, Trump advisors began strategizing just days after the election about how to construct a legal argument for advancing their own completely illegitimate electors in what a federal judge has described as a coup in search of a legal theory. The Post reports that 2 days after the election, Trump lawyer Cleta Mitchell wrote to John Eastman asking, quote, "What would you think of producing a legal memo outlining the constitutional role of state legislators in designating electors?" By November 28, Eastman had penned a 7-page memo entitled The Constitutional Authority of State Legislatures to Choose Electors. And a copy was emailed to White House staffers, directing them to pass it along to Trump. Trump's legal team was aware that this was not legally sound, as an aide to Chief of Staff Mark Meadows told the committee. Despite that, the Trump campaign pressed full steam ahead in organizing their electors, telling them not to tell anyone about their plan. Keep it hush hush. Which someone who thought their plan was above board would not have to say. On the day of the Electoral College vote, Trump's ultra-loyal Attorney General, William Barr, met with Trump and then promptly resigned, later telling the January 6th committee that he'd told Trump multiple times, including at that December 14 meeting, that his claims about election fraud were BS, but that the president remained undeterred and frankly uninterested in hearing the facts or the truth. 4 days after that December 14 Electoral College vote, in which his fake electors were not seated, Trump met in the Oval Office with his favorite little gang of conspiracy theorists, including Rudy Giuliani and Michael Flynn and Sidney Powell, the Kraken lady, where they threw around various ideas on how to steal the election Trump had lost, including imposing martial law to seize the voting machines. The very next day, Trump tweeted his infamous invite for his MAGA faithful to come to the Capitol on January 6th. The next big date on the electoral calendar, when the vice president officially enters the winning candidates into the record. He tweeted, "Be there. It will be wild." Look, it is very clear at this point that this was a coordinated campaign to help Trump hold on to the presidency at any cost. One that started before the votes were even counted. Here is Trump in September 2020.
Will you commit to making sure that there is a peaceful transferal of power after the election?
Well, we're going to have to see what happens. You know that I've been complaining very strongly about the ballots, and the ballots are a disaster.
And, I understand that, but people are rioting. Do you commit to making sure that there's a peaceful transferal of power?
We want to get rid of the ballots, and you'll have a very we'll have a very peaceful. There won't be a transfer, frankly. There'll be a continuation.
Get rid of the ballots, and we'll have a peaceful transfer. There won't be a transfer of power. And here is how former Attorney General Barr described election night to the January 6th committee as a plan that had been in the works for weeks.
Right out of the box on election night, the president claimed that there was major fraud underway. I mean, this happened, as far as I could tell, before there was actually any potential of looking at evidence. And I didn't think much of that because people had been talking for weeks and everyone understood for weeks that that was going to be what happened on election night.
We are about to learn even more about the role Trump played in these schemes to overturn the election during tomorrow's January 6th hearing, with Congressman Adam Schiff saying that they will show evidence of the president's involvement in pushing for these fake electors, as well as covering his pressure campaign on state officials. We will hear from those officials, including Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger and his deputy, as well as Arizona House Speaker Rusty Bowers. We'll also hear from Georgia election worker Shay Moss, one of the women who faced a barrage of threats after the Trump campaign falsely claimed that she had opened suitcases of fake ballots. Joining me now is Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel and civil rights attorney and former prosecutor Charles Coleman Jr. Thank you both for being here. And Attorney Nessel, I want to start with you because I want to point really quickly to two pieces of reporting. This is from CNN. They had obtained previously audio where Michonne Maddock, who is the co-chair of the Michigan Republican Party in your state, and who is a fake elector, admits that the Trump campaign requested that they send fake electors. And this is what the quote was. We fought to seat the electors. The Trump campaign asked us to do that. Another piece of CNN reporting is that a Trump campaign staffer told CNN that Rudy Giuliani had worked closely on the seven-state stunt with these fake electors with Christina Bob, who's a correspondent for pro-Trump propaganda network One America News. Is it your understanding, just on looking at the facts just in Michigan, that this was a coordinated Trump campaign effort to seat fake electors that went back not to December, but to the actual election?
Well, Joy, first of all, thank you for having me. There's no question that this was a coordinated effort. I mean, it started, quite honestly, the day before the election. I had a conversation with both of our U.S. attorneys. And I said, hey, listen, you guys are going to stay out of this, right? You're not going to, you know, intercede where it's inappropriate for you to do so. And they said, no, of course, we're not going to do that. Well, immediately after the election, contrary to what DOJ policy had been, they started to investigate in both the Eastern and the Western districts. Now, our U.S. attorney from the Eastern District, the Trump appointed U.S. attorney, just came out last week and said that he was ordered to look for election fraud. And he reported back that he found no election fraud in the city of Detroit. But nonetheless, you might remember that Trump actually ordered our state House Speaker and our Senate Majority Leader from Michigan to the Oval Office to have a conversation on November 20th, right before the election was certified in Michigan, to try to mount a pressure campaign on them. Now, they did ultimately the legal thing and the right thing, and they refused to, to cave to his demands. But of course, it was then later, after the election was certified November 23rd in our state, that those individuals, and you just showed it on screen, including the co-chair of the Michigan Republican Party and one of our state reps, tried to storm into the state Senate. The reason they did that is because, according to our Constitution, the electors have to officially vote at 2 p.m. that day in the state Senate, or it's not counted. It's not legitimate. But of course, they sent in that fake slate of electors Nonetheless, even though I can tell you I was in the state Senate that day and they were outside because Governor Whitmer had ordered, you know, dozens and dozens of MSP, Michigan State Police troopers, to guard the Capitol so they could not force their way into the building, which we were afraid they would try to do when there was the threat of violence that day by one of the state reps. So clearly this was a coordinated campaign. And let me say one other thing. We received information not long thereafter that, of course, this false slate of electors had officially been filed with the National Archivist. So we were placed on notice that this was, you know, fraudulently filed with them. So clearly there was a campaign from the beginning to the end, and it was coordinated by the Trump campaign. All you have to do is look at the public information and open sources to see that that is what occurred.
And Charles, I mean, what we have here, just my producer, you know, really sort of laid out a timeline. I mean, going all the way back to November 7th, you have Trump calling Republicans on the Wayne County Board of Elections saying, hey, you know, I need you to certify these other electors. Like, it's a relentless campaign that goes almost to election night on November 3rd to try to pressure Republicans in multiple states, even calling people, as Attorney Nestle just said, to the White House and saying, hey, I'm going to pressure you in person. The thing about it that makes it feel illegal is that the state laws in all of these states say that the electors are based on the vote. And the result of the vote was that Biden won. These electors had no connection to the state legislature. They had no connection to the secretaries of state in these states. They literally had no legal foundation. And everyone, Eastman, et cetera, knew it. That is a crime.
Well, it's
right?
Clear. It's clear, Joy, from what we're learning and from the information that continues to come out, is that President Trump had unequivocal intent to commit conspiracy to basically steal this election. And so everything that you're talking about that's surfacing is being sort of wrapped up for the DOJ in hopes that Merrick Garland and the Department of Justice will go ahead and charge him on the myriad different acts that he at this point has shown clear intent of doing. One of the things that has been a challenge in the past has been connecting any of the behavior with the requisite intent and then connecting that to the president. In this case, with everything that has been coming out, all the information in this direct timeline that you're talking about before January 6th, it shows how intentional, how deliberate, how purposeful the president and his team were in setting this up in order to have what happened on January 6th take place. So you're right. It does sound illegal. It absolutely is illegal. And what they're doing in this by releasing this information is showing the clear intent that's necessary, because we don't have a successful action. We don't have the conclusion. All we had is the attempt. So in terms of being able to establish the attempt, we have to establish the intent. And that's the thing that we're doing with connecting all of these dots and why all of this information is as powerful as it is.
Indeed. And let's go. I want to go back to Eastman, because he is sort of one of the most sort of fascinating figures here. He's somebody who he's a law professor. I mean, he's a mentor of people like Ted Cruz. People know this. People know him. I mean, he was mentored, I should say, by some of the same people who mentored Ted Cruz. He then writes an email. Eastman does. On December 19th, he writes this email that says that electors would be dead on arrival in Congress. So he knows it's illegal. His reasoning is no state legislator had acted to certify them as valid. That's true. 4 days later, however, he then writes to other Trump advisors and saying the fact that we have multiple electors in states demonstrates the uncertainty of either. This should be enough, he writes. 4 days after the January 6th insurrection, he then gets a redacted email about the elections and he admits the plan was illegal, saying, tell us in layman's language from someone whose name is redacted. What the heck happened with the dual electors, please? No legislator certified them, he responds, because governors refused to call them into session, so they had no authority. As Attorney General of Michigan, Dana Nessel, is there any way to uncover who these people are that he's interacting with? Because in the first case, who else could he be talking to but his client, Donald Trump, to make him change his mind all of a sudden and say something he knew was illegal is legal? And then in second case, he's getting dressed down for it not working. Is there any way that the public can find out who these mystery people are? Or that a state could, like yours?
Right. No, I mean, listen, I referred our case to the feds and to the DOJ quite some time ago, actually sort of begging for them to take this case up, because initially the Department of Justice was refusing to look at this matter. And it was so clear, and I think it was very cleverly laid out, actually, by, you know, by your network. MSNBC, I think, did a tremendous job of connecting the dots, so much so that I thought it was inescapable that people could conclude anything other than that there was this effort to completely undermine the election and subvert the vote, utilizing this what seems like a harebrained scheme, using the false slate of electors that actually almost worked. But, you know, what I pledged to do in our state, because this was so obvious, was to charge these individuals myself. But the problem is, as individual attorneys general, there's only so much we can do in our individual states because we don't have jurisdiction outside of our respective states. And so that's something that really needed to be coordinated and done by the Department of Justice. I'm glad that the January 6th committee is laying it out as plainly as they are. And I don't see how the DOJ can do anything but take action. It's the evidence is overwhelming.
And 6 in 10 Americans at this point believe that Donald Trump should be charged with a crime for his role in the insurrection. And 6 in 10 also believe the committee is conducting a fair and impartial election. I'm with the 60%. Let's see what happens. Thank you, Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel and Charles Coleman Jr. Up next on The Readout, Adam Kinzinger warns that January 6th wasn't the end of MAGA violence. And we're seeing new examples of the menacing and threats being used by Republicans against other Republicans. The Readout continues after this.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
On the far right of the Republican Party, the so-called MAGA movement has morphed from just diehard support for the former president into a violent, increasingly extremist political faction that is dangerous, not just to Democrats, but also to Republicans. Take a look at a new digital ad from the front-running Missouri Republican Senate candidate and former Missouri governor, Eric Greitens. Screenshots from the ad show Greitens brandishing a pump-action shotgun, declaring, "I'm a Navy SEAL," and calling for the hunting of so-called rhinos, Republicans in name only, while flanked by men in camo and tactical gear, breaking into a house in what looks like a military raid, with Greitens and his pet shotgun inviting his followers to join the MAGA movement to get your own rhino hunting license. Now, it is worth noting that while Eric Greitens is a former Navy SEAL, as he boasts in the video, he isn't one now. The Navy refused to reinstate him as a SEAL in 2019, only allowing him to return to the reserves. Also, using military uniforms the way he does in that video is strictly not allowed by the actual U.S. military, not the fake one he's raiding that fictional rhino house with to what, kill them for not being MAGA enough. A year before he was turfed out as a Navy SEAL, Greitens resigned as Missouri's governor amid criminal charges and an ethics investigation stemming from reports he tried to blackmail a hairdresser he'd had an affair with after allegedly locking her in his basement and sexually assaulting her while he recorded her on video without her permission. And earlier this year, his former wife alleged in court documents that he physically abused her and their young son. Those allegations led to Greitens being temporarily unable to even have a gun. This latest apparent endorsement of violence in the name of MAGA comes as one of the two Republicans on the January 6th committee, Adam Kinzinger, revealed a threat sent to his home in a letter addressed to his wife.
We got it a couple days ago, and it threatens to execute me as well as my wife and 5-month-old child. I've never seen or had anything like that. There's violence in the future, I'm going to tell you. And until we get a grip on telling people the truth, we can't expect any differently.
The same extremism was also on display at the Texas Republican Party convention, where far-right activists targeted right-wing Republican Congressman Dan Crenshaw, using a derogatory nickname coined by none other than Tucker Carlson.
Eyepatch McCain. Hey, Eyepatch McCain. Look at Eyepatch McCain right here. You're a rhino. You're a globalist.
This radical behavior may seem new from the Republican Party, but it's not a bug, not anymore. It's part of an increasingly overt shift since Donald Trump came along toward open political and physical thuggery inside the once grand old party, embodied by the increasing mainstreaming inside the party of far-right extremists, even fascist groups like the Proud Boys. The longtime leader of the Proud Boys, Enrique Tarrio, is charged with seditious conspiracy related to January 6th. So is the leader of the far-right Oath Keepers, Stuart Rhodes. And Tarrio's history of political extremist violence and harassment has been long known in the state of Florida. In 2018, he led a mob-style attack on House Speaker Nancy Pelosi at a protest organized by the Miami-Dade Republican Party. The Miami-Dade Republican chair had to apologize for the harassment of Speaker Pelosi in 2018, but we have come full circle. Tarrio was later the head of Latinos for Trump, sitting behind the former president at speeches and visiting the White House. And the Proud Boys have since been fully absorbed by the party in a marriage of violence and politics. They've now effectively taken over the Miami-Dade Republican Party. And with me now is NBC News senior reporter Ben Collins and Andy Campbell, senior editor for HuffPost and author of the upcoming book, We Are Proud Boys, How a Right-Wing Street Gang Ushered in a New Era of American Extremism. Thank you both for being here. And Andy, Ben hit me to you, so I'm going to ask you to just answer that question. How did a right-wing extremist group become a mainstream part of the Republican Party and our politics?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Joy. And what you're seeing here is a culmination of the normalization of political violence in this country. The Proud Boys have helped foment that atmosphere by positioning political violence as legitimate political discourse. And so what you're seeing with these Republicans getting attacked by their own party is a machine, an apparatus that's ready to mobilize whenever Tucker Carlson or Donald Trump point at something they dislike. You have extremists like the Proud Boys ready to jump in there and bring violence to that situation. And so you're seeing it, you know, the people who attacked Crenshaw were Proud Boys, right? You're seeing the Proud Boys show up at Pride events now because Fox News is, you know, angry at LGBTQ at this point. So what we're seeing is a normalization of political violence, and what's scary, and as Ben will tell you, it is going to lead to more violence.
It is. And Ben, you know, you've written about the fact that they have migrated. I mean, we know Tarrio was arrested for pulling a Black Lives Matter sign down and having, you know, magazines, gun magazines he wasn't supposed to have in the District of Columbia. Then he got charged with seditious conspiracy. But you've written about the fact that this kind of thing has migrated from being very race focused and very Democrat focused, like the attack on Pelosi, to now being trans focused and LGBTQ focused. Why?
Yeah, in this space, we call it the main character effect. There's a main character every week on Fox News or on the Donald or all these far right wing websites. They focus on one specific totem that will embody this larger culture issue they have a problem with. Last week it was Drag Queen Story Hour. A few months ago it was critical race theory. But regardless of what it is, it comes from the top down. It's a Fox News targeted thing, or, you know, maybe from a specific politician like Ron DeSantis. And then from there, you know, they get their marching orders. The militias go to the same message boards these people do. They say, hey, you know, we're angry at drag queens this week. Well, there's a drag queen story hour in San Francisco. Let's go there. And that's exactly what the Proud Boys did 2 weekends ago. They went to a drag queen story hour. And now, you know, one of the drag queens who was there is scarred for life. The kids who were there are scarred from being yelled at from these people, you know, dressed up in militia garb. So that's the thing. Right now, every week, there is a new main character on the right. And if you are that main character, you're in deep trouble. And you're probably a minority or part of some other group that's regularly persecuted on Fox News.
That's the chicken and egg conversation I want you to answer for me, Andy. I mean, you've had Adam Kinzinger call out Kevin McCarthy, who wants to be Speaker of the House. He's the leader of the Republicans in the House. And he said, where is Kevin McCarthy? He's supposed to defend his members. Now, granted, Crenshaw is MTG or a crazy or isn't an MTG or a crazy, but the Republican leader should say something. Does McCarthy appreciate McCain's war record? Maybe after the speaker race yet? That's it. It's like he's sort of going after him. But I wonder how did the Proud Boys, which is an extremist group that, what do they call themselves? Western chauvinists, whose leader is a Black Cuban who hates Black Lives Matter. So I don't get him at all. But where do the Proud Boys come from? And are they really connected to the Republican Party or using the Republican Party for their own ends?
Absolutely. Well, listen, a number of Proud Boys are running for office even after their outsized role in January 6th are running for office in this election. I think something like 30 of them are running for office. And that's because they know that even if they don't win any seats, that securing friendships, running for office, makes them look more political than the other street gangs you might have seen at Unite the Right, which Proud Boys were at too, by the way.
Yeah.
But they know that the political aspect by gaining relationships in the GOP, they look more like a political arm than a street gang. And it's worked because they have relationships with the GOP elite. Ann Coulter used them as a bodyguard. They were bodyguards at Matt Gaetz events. They are good friends with Roger Stone, who counts Enrique Tarrio as one of his best friends. Right. Enrique Tarrio, the leader of a street gang, is one of Roger Stone, Trump's confidant's best friends. And so the GOP has not only embraced them, but it celebrates them even after January 6th.
What do they want? I mean, they were founded by the guy who started Vice News, you know, and now Tarrio's. What is it that they want? What's their end game? Is it, you know, low taxes for the rich like Republicans want? Like, what do they want?
Well, Gavin McGinnis, the founder of both Vice and the Proud Boys, wanted them to be the enforcement arm of the GOP. They wanted them to bring violence into the streets and bring violence to anything that the GOP wants them to, because they recognize that these old crusty conservatives aren't going to get out there and fight. These guys are going to get out there and fight and give it such a political bent that it has justification. And so they've done that very, very successfully. And we found that even after their leaders have been arrested for sedition charges in January 6th, these guys are still out in the street every weekend fighting the battles pointed out to them by Tucker Carlson and the Republican elite.
Ben Collins, that is called brown shirtism. That is fascism. No.
Look, that's where it's coming from. That is, and that's where it's headed, Joy. This is it, certainly where it's all going. This is a street gang. That's what it is. And if they need marching orders, you know, they go to the same people. And if those people are in office, they think they can get diplomatic immunity. That's what they think is happening. And by the way, they will try to ingratiate themselves. Angie knows all about this. They'll try to ingratiate themselves into, you know, police departments, local municipalities, sort of make it so that, you know, when things get a little hectic at these protest events, they're not the ones who are getting collared. It's the people they're protesting against. They want to start fights that somebody fights back at. That's the point, to make them look like the victims that they are fighting back against. That's the whole point of this thing. They don't want to look like they're starting the fight. They just want to look like they are sort of in the line of fire of the left. That's the game plan here.
Yeah, the physical enforcers, basically the brown shirts for the Republican Party, and they want to ingratiate themselves with police until they're beating the crap out of police at the Capitol on January 6th during the insurrection. Ben Collins, Andy Campbell, please come back. I think this is such a valuable conversation. We need to know more about these groups. Thank you both. Still ahead, Texas Republicans show just how far to the right their party is willing to go to please its base, embracing guns, Trump's big lie, and ugly anti-LGBTQ rhetoric. We'll be right back.
It's Monday, everyone. We're happy to have you here on this Monday night. Lots of news to get to tonight.
Make more of your Mondays on MSNBC with Jen Psaki and Rachel Maddow back to back.
If you were talking to a voter, what would you say to them about why this case matters to them?
Was this the kind of proceeding you would expect in a typical New York DA's case, or does this really feel different?
Inside with Jen Psaki at 8 p.m. Eastern, followed by The Rachel Maddow Show at 9, Mondays on MSNBC. Monday night. Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
Texas Republicans held their convention over the weekend and laid out a far-right platform with red meat for the MAGA fanatics who now dominate a party that once belonged to the likes of George Herbert Walker Bush. It should be no surprise that they embraced the big lie, declaring President Biden's victory against Trump illegitimate. They scolded one of their own, Senator John Cornyn, for even participating in the watered-down talks on gun legislation. Listen to them booing him.
May God continue to bless our great state of Texas.
But it is their 40-page platform that displays just how far right they've shifted, including calling homosexuality an abnormal lifestyle choice, calling for an end to all gun safety measures, and requiring Texas students to learn about the humanity of the preborn child in school, while also prohibiting teaching sex education. Join me now, Matthew Dowd, MSNBC contributor and founder of Country Over Party. Matthew, what is going on inside the Texas Republican Party? I mean, this platform, it's bananas. They also want to retain the right to secede. They want to repeal the entire Voting Rights Act of 1965, rejecting the Equal Rights Amendment for women, repealing hate crime laws. So they want hate crimes to be legal, I guess. Arming teachers, defending capital punishment. I could go on. Oh, protecting Confederate monuments. Can't miss that. And ending gay marriage, reversing that right. Also penalizing corporations in Texas who boycott the state because the state apparently is nuts. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, my fear is, which is this is connected so much to January 6th, because what Texas is showing is what the Republicans want the country to be. And so Texas is just one step ahead in this craziness of where they want the rest of the country to go. So as we saw with the anti-abortion, anti-choice stuff that Texas did, as soon as Texas did it, 5, 6, 7, 8 other states did it. And so I think what they're, which actually is in somewhat good news, they're telling us what why they want to dismantle this democracy and why they don't want to be held accountable for January 6th, because this is their plan. This is what they want to do. And as you laid out, the leaders of the Republican Party have lost control, have lost any guardrails for the grassroots of the Republican Party. The grassroots of the Republican Party, which is crazy far right, is now in charge.
Yeah. Clearly. I mean, they're talking about they want to secede. I mean, don't threaten us with a good time if you're going to try to create an apartheid state in America. We don't like apartheid and don't want it. I mean, I want to ask you just about some other elements. I mean, the Republican Party has really, to me, we mainstreamed the Tea Party. The media allowed them to mainstream themselves. Then they were the baseline. Now this MAGA crew is the baseline. But increasingly, it's the Proud Boys who are the baseline. We just did a piece, did a segment with a couple of experts on that. They're becoming the new baseline, the thug crew. And you see Eric Greitens embracing the idea of, you know, storming into Republican homes if they're not MAGA enough and killing them, I guess, with a pump action shotgun and an army. Your thoughts?
So I think you've hit it right, as usual. You've hit it right on the head. It's like Frankenstein made a monster, and then the monster woke up and now is destroying the village, and he's lost control of it, and that's the way it is. Eric Greitens is a perfect example. He's one step further than Donald Trump, who was one step further than Sarah Palin, and Doug Mastriano, the Republican nominee in Pennsylvania, who was at the January 6th and organized buses to go to the coup down there. He's the Republican nominee for governor of Pennsylvania. So we can't consider these people isolated. They're the dominant theme of a major legacy party of the United States of America, who has an opportunity to win the Senate and win the House in 2020, in this year, 2022. That's my fear, because if that happens, goodbye democracy.
Oh, 100%. I mean, I just read, and this is just before we were in the commercial break, the man who is running for attorney general in Nevada has said that the black current attorney general, Aaron Ford, should be hung from an effing crane, She should be hung from an effing crane, lynched, the black attorney general of Nevada. This person's name is Sigal Chadha. So that kind of, that is the way that they talk now, which is why when I saw the Eric Greitens thing, I'm like, he's mainstream Republican. That's what the party is now. How does the Democratic Party respond when they are everywhere in every state, increasingly openly touting violence, lynching, and insurrection?
So the first thing the Democrats Party has to do is realize we're in an entirely different time and a different scenario, and their old plans of talking about 22 different policies and what's their plan on X, Y, and Z, they ought to throw it out. We're not in the normal time. We're not in that. They have to realize that a culture war and a war for America has been launched, and it's been launched for 10 or 15 years. And the Democrats keep trying to think they're going to organize the kitchen at the barracks while this war is going on. Democrats have to step up and believe and talk like this. This is a war for the soul and heart of America. That's what they have to realize. It's not about whatever rate on education or a tax rate. It's not about any of that. It is about the heart and soul of America. And Democrats have to run that campaign just like the Republicans do, not the violence and obviously rational thought. But they have to realize they're in a war, and you have to come to the war with that understanding.
And do you think that, I mean, give us some advice for the media, because, you know, again, the media did mainstream the Tea Party and doesn't want to be in a war with the Republican Party. Let's just be clear. In general, the media does not want to be at war with the Republicans. They want to treat both sides the same, but both sides are not the same. Right. At this point, no. You were a Republican strategist. I've been a lifelong Democrat. We agree on all of this. How do we get us all out of this both sides sort of trajectory?
Well, I mean, I think that's the fundamental choice, and that the fundamental choice is if you're a person in the media that covers the news, it can't just be, well, the Republicans stand for autocracy and Democrats stand for democracy, and let's see how this game plays out. Because as part of democracy is free, is media. Part of democracy, yeah, is freedom of the press. And the media has to, I actually thought one thing I thought that the media should do a better job of, which is how do people in the media conduct themselves in an autocratic country, the ones that believe, yeah, in free media. We need to think more like that in the media and less like this is just A and B and decide. Let the voters decide. That's the point, yeah, we have to give up. We have to tell the voters what the threat is, just like we do, Joy. We tell them about inflation and we tell them about, yeah, job growth, and we tell them about a hurricane, and we tell them about tornadoes, and we tell them about wildfire. We have to treat this assault just like we have to tell them about the assault, yep, on democracy.
Adam Kinzinger is as conservative as it gets. If he and I sat down, we would agree on literally nothing politically. He's getting death threats to his little kid and his wife. That's where we are. The monster is eating itself. Matthew Dowd, yes, thank you. Up next, the complicated history of Juneteenth and how it finally became a federal holiday, thanks to the tireless work of advocates like Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee. She joins us straight ahead. Stay with us. On June 19, 1865, Major General Gordon Granger of the Union Army arrived in Galveston, Texas, with a message. Enslaved people in Texas were now free. The day became known as Juneteenth, the blend of June and 19th, one of the oldest African-American holidays, marking one of America's early efforts to reverse a brutal human experiment. The order that Black Texans were free is known as General Order No. 3. It wasn't very long, quite simply a belated announcement of freedom, arriving 2.5 years after President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. You see, it was one thing to free enslaved people, quite another thing to enforce that reality in parts of the country that were clinging to keeping humans in bondage to maintain white financial prosperity, especially in places like Texas, where cotton and sugar plantations relied heavily on slave labor. Another thing about General Order No. 3, it included that freedom meant an absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves. Well, this didn't go over so well, inciting white violence. Black Texans were shot and killed rather than set free. Slavery continued in other forms and by different names. The violence continues today by those refusing to accept Black freedom and humanity, including insurrectionists who waved Confederate battle flags and erected a gallows at the U.S. Capitol, and a gunman who targeted and massacred Black people in Buffalo only a month and a half ago. And so today, as in 1865, Juneteenth is a day that celebrates freedom. But until true equality arrives, Juneteenth is also an act of resistance, celebrated boldly and in defiance of every attempt to take equality away. Some call it Freedom Day or Emancipation Day, a precursor to the 4th of July, our actual Independence Day, a collective expression of Black freedom. Today, for the second time, it is recognized nationally as a day for all Americans to commemorate the end of the abomination of slavery here. Thanks to Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, who was pivotal to getting Juneteenth recognized as a federal holiday. Like the long road to freedom, this holiday also came with a fight. And Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee joins me next. Today, the U.S. recognizes its newest federal holiday, Juneteenth. But it's a day Black Americans in states like Texas and Colorado have been celebrating since the late 1800s. It's a day of hope mixed with a hard look at the tensions and hostility Black people still face in this country, more than 150 years after emancipation. And joining me now is Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas. Congresswoman, it is great to see you. And I have to show you this. I hope you can see it on your monitor. This was your reaction. And this is from The Big Payback, the movie that you're very much featured in, when Juneteenth passed and became a holiday. Take a look.
I declare and proclaim that America has just gotten again.
They have the ability now to call themselves the supporters of the Juneteenth national holiday. This is America.
For Black Americans who say we want stuff done, like we want things like police reform, we wanted things like voting rights reform. That's the stuff that we need done that's more critical than something symbolic like a holiday. What would you say to them?
Well, first of all, Joy, thank you so very much for having me and happy Juneteenth. I would say same what I said, that Juneteenth was actually the beginning. And I have been in the fight for police reform, the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, George Floyd Law Enforcement and Integrity Act, voting rights over the decades that I've been in the United States Congress, privileged to be representing my constituents. But here's where we are. One of the things that Juneteenth, after a decade of fighting for that legislation and introducing it for the first time, the federal holiday in 2020, and receiving a million petitions from Opal Lee, working collaboratively, it is now a statement that has never been made before. Juneteenth, of course, commemorates 2 years of waiting past 1863 for Texans remaining in slavery, the brutality of slavery. But what it does is it opens up the nation to a discussion of the brutality of slavery, the strength of the slaves, how they built this nation, which means the next step should be an understanding why voting rights is absolutely imperative and the John Robert Lewis bill should be passed, or why H.R. 40 should be passed. So the idea was that once all of my colleagues, unanimous in the Senate, 415 votes in the House, voted for it and saw that nothing happened, nothing collapsed. We were able to look at this issue together and all of the festivities and commemorations. I was in church yesterday with what I had promised my constituents, that we would honor the slaves and our ancestors in a memorial service. I believe it opens the door to pushing now for voting rights, for pushing now for ensuring that we, in fact, have real gun safety laws, for pushing now that we protect democracy, and for pushing now for H.R. 40, the commission to study slavery and develop reparation proposals, the big payback.
You know, not everyone is trying to sort of celebrate together. Dr. Mehmet Oz, who's running for a statewide office in Pennsylvania, he originally went on Truth Social, which, why would anybody do that? But he goes on Truth Social and he tweeted, he deleted the word equality that he'd written on a post that he was celebrating the equality and justice, et cetera, on Juneteenth. What is going on in a party where you can't write the word equality and get away with it if you're running for office?
Well, I think people should distinguish who now has taken hold of the Republican Party, the grand old party, the party of Lincoln, the party of H.W. Bush, the party of George W. Bush, the party of the Secretary of State, the late Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice. That party is off to the side. What we have now are individuals that embrace insurrectionists, embrace false stories and falsehoods about the election. And so what I would say is I wish that Mr. Oz, Dr. Oz, would have kept to his own views, his heart.
Yeah.
But he did not.
Yeah.
He got beat up.
Yeah.
And he immediately dropped the word equality.
Back down.
I would want to be standing on equality rather than dropping equality. And I ask him to look into his heart. What kind of America are we if we can't fight for equality?
Amen. And you know, the Texas Republican Party is something else. We're going to have to come bring you back on and just talk just about that. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, thank you.
I just saw their platform.
Ooh,
it's atrocious. I mean,
it is. Congresswoman, thank you. And happy Juneteenth. That is tonight's readout.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at MSNBC.com/win.